We dedicate this episode to the memory of Yuri Gustinčić, the father of my very good friend Andrei, who is being laid to rest today in Slovenia. Yuri, perhaps Slovenia's most revered journalist, was an amazing guy who certainly lived in interesting times. 2 years ago, he was honored by President Danilo Turk with the Order of Service for his, quote, contribution to open, tolerant, and cultured public dialogue. Quoting President Turk, "The beginning of his career goes back to the time of the Cold War. He found the ways and words to report truth even when it was not a desired currency, setting an example of professionalism," end quote. Yuri expressed surprise at the honor in his acceptance speech, saying that, quote, "journalists usually do not expect much good in life," end quote. "It was my honor to know him, to spend time with him, and to be inspired by his ethic. Havla, Yuri. And nazvedenja."
Prime Minister Churchill has warned us that there will be many allied feints, deceptive moves. And we've also been told to expect an invasion story from the Germans. In this way, the Nazis might hope to make the patriots in the conquered countries reveal themselves, and thus reduce the effectiveness of these groups when our landing does actually start.
On the fifth day of June 1944, a fleet of more than 4,000 ships put out from England. This was D-Day. Fourth anniversary of the Battle of Dunkirk, and the Allied armies were striking back. The great fleet was underway. The morning of June 6th, this was the battleground. Fierce fighting around Caen. Vast squadrons of bombers and transports led the way. More than 11,000 planes spearheading the attack. Paratroopers landed in Normandy behind the coastal defenses. Landings made with timing and precision, perfected only through scores of rehearsals. Barges approached shore ready for instant action. Some bearing artillery and rocket guns already opening fire. Today, the armies of the United Nations have made their first landings on the soil of Western Europe. Another of the great decisive battles of world history has been joined. This is the day for which free people long have waited. This is D-Day.
Mr. McGee! Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
We hope you like us when we're angry. Hi, I'm Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Carianis.
And welcome back to the Angry History Show.
If you've been following us on Facebook.com/AngryHistory or at Angry History on Twitter, you know we've been posting pictures and reports from our friend who hit D-Day for the 70th anniversary remembrances. We're going to bring him on for a report, but today we wanted to give some background on this greatest of amphibious assaults.
It was interesting. This morning I was having coffee with my boy who's three. I got back late from New York last night, and so we were just hanging out. I was doing some prep for this episode and just hanging out with him, and I threw one of Uncle Mojo's videos on. It was an air show, and Jack was asking me what all this was and then this place, and I said, you know, this is Uncle Mojo went to Normandy, a place in France, and this is a place where a huge landing took place and a big battle. And then he cut me off and he asked if there were bad guys there, and I said, not anymore. So it just hit me. It was just so strange. You know, obviously you want to keep it simple for kids and be honest with them at the same time, but just to be able to say, not anymore, it just made it all come screaming into the front of my brain what this thing really was and the sacrifice and the impact that it had.
They really made an effort, too. It's easy to say that, and people think maybe that it's just on one level that it's a joke, and it's, of course, the Nazis are gone. But also, they made a real effort, as they are, hopefully, with all the World War One things, to not look at it as make the Germans come there and feel like they're being, you know, punished for what happened in the past.
Well, no.
You know, after all, we are all allies now and have been for quite some time, so.
Yeah. Oh, and you hear about that guy, they called him the Beast of Omaha, the German, who's still alive. I think he's still alive. Maybe he died a couple of years ago, but he was the one who was manning one of those machine guns, and he estimates that, you know, he may have been responsible for 1,000 deaths that day, and it warped his life. This was not a happy man killing Americans on the beach 70 years ago, but But hey, I guess we're all pals now, right?
Yeah, the experiences on the ground face to face, especially in World War I across the trenches, would have been much more similar than they were to people who are back at Whitehall or back in Washington, D.C. or anything like that. So,
yep. Let's note, though, actually, as we're going forward here, that the D in D-Day, by the way, doesn't really stand for anything special. It's just day. You know, it's an operational phrase. It had been used for many operations prior, but this was, of course, the biggest, and so it claimed the name as its own. Interesting, June 6th, 1944, was the fourth anniversary of Dunkirk. That was the evacuation of the British Expeditionary Force across the English Channel. Total miracle of seamanship, where the men were saved, but they left tons of equipment behind for the Nazis, and must have been infuriating and upsetting to have the Nazis get that equipment. You know, I don't know, past couple of days, if you've been following what's been happening in Iraq now, we're recording this again, June 14th, 2014. Flag Day. I think, like, you, me, Don Winston, and, like, maybe, well, probably a lot of our listeners remember it's Flag Day, but no one else knows what the hell Flag Day is anymore. But anyway, if you've been following what's been happening in Iraq, I've been reading a lot of reaction from Iraq war vets, you know, seeing this Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, these militants riding around on American equipment in towns that our guys had taken years ago. You know, very hard for them. I think regardless of where one stands on our going into Iraq, it's times like this when it's good to remember the sacrifice, you know. There was a sense of shared sacrifice in this country during the Second World War, and I just don't see that now.
We're going to close with General Eisenhower 2 years after the war and his statement about the invasion and what the cost was, and really calling the young people to solidify those gains and keep working towards it. And I think that that's, Owen and I have talked about this many times, about how there was sort of a handing off of foreign policy, regardless of what the party was. There was kind of a common thread a lot of times where you knew what was coming. Like there was sort of this shared idea and just a different plans of how to achieve that goal, and it's not the same today.
No, the levels of polarization are just so extreme now that it's, you know, we really can't talk to each other, can we? Very well.
I don't know, man. It's upsetting. Wireless operators are at their posts. Each ship is filled with the men of the BEF and of the French Army in Flanders. They are on their way home. Home from the hell that is Dunkirk. We have all heard the full story from the Prime Minister of how the Royal Navy, using nearly 1,000 ships, has brought back nearly 350,000 men. Now you are off burning Dunkirk. Now you are to see that evacuation in progress. You will see the Navy in action, Nazi planes overhead. You will see the beaches of Dunkirk under enemy fire, our own guns replying. You will see the calm waters dotted with hundreds of men as they wade or swim out to the ships. The triumph that turned a major military disaster into a miracle of deliverance.
So, after Dunkirk, Prime Minister Churchill cautioned people that wars were not won by evacuations like the one at Dunkirk, and the Allies were itching to get back to mainland France. Our Soviet allies, who were still Hitler's allies at the time of Dunkirk, speaking of people changing their minds on things and consistent policy, they also wanted a second front because they were taking a pounding in the east at that time.
Oh, yes.
So, after years of planning and reviewing his meteorologist's weather report, Supreme Allied Commander Dwight D. Eisenhower simply said, "Okay, we'll go."
And the liberation was on. 6,000 ships, 1,600 aircraft and gliders, 10,000 fighters, 11,000 tons of bombs, 13,000 paratroopers. Here's Ike's message to the troops for the operation, codenamed Overlord.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the Great Crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeats in open battle, man to man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home front have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war, and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. we will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
You can hear that Eisenhower has confidence in his men, in his plan, in the equipment. But in his pocket, he carried a very different message. Just in case. Why don't you read this one for us, Owen?
This is from the old history file, you know. Quote, our landings in the Cherbourg-Havre area have failed to gain a satisfactory foothold, and I have withdrawn the troops. My decision to attack at this time and place was based upon the best information available. The troops, the air, the navy did all that bravery and devotion to duty could do. If any blame or fault is attached to the attempt, it is mine alone. End quote.
The note was fated to remain in Ike's pockets. But picture yourself at home, huddled on your furniture-sized radio, mm-hmm. you know, staring down at it. No TV, no iPhone, no computer. You're listening to the landings. Your stream of information is limited to that scratchy voice tuned in with a wooden knob. You'd have felt that doubt, too, whether you had a note in your pocket or not, about whether or not this was going to succeed. And keep in mind, the English Channel had blocked the Germans from crossing it for all this time and invading England. So you really would have had doubts about going the other way.
Yep.
Now we're back out in the newsroom with our long cable. And once again, here is Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott.
The Allied invasion of Western Europe, as you know, has begun. Such an operation, carrying thousands and hundreds of thousands of troops across water to land them on a hostile shore, is one of the most dangerous of all military operations. There have been few such vast military amphibious operations in all history. Some have failed, but some have succeeded. And no such operation has ever been prepared with the thoroughness of this Allied landing on the European continent. The Allies have been getting ready for it for years. The British have been looking forward to this day ever since Dunkirk. And the moment the United States got into the war, our military leaders realized that the main road to the defeat of Germany lay through the occupied lands of Western Europe, and they began to plan accordingly. Our leaders have also realized that they must strike with overwhelming force. In some military operations, an initial repulse might have little effect, but in this European invasion, it might be fatal, for it would be a disastrous blow to the morale of the people of the conquered nations. So, the plans for the invasion were more complex and more complete than any that military strategists have ever had to work out before. Germany's dash across the Low Countries and France was simple in comparison. So was the German attack on Russia, vast as that operation was. The Allied landings in North Africa and in Sicily involved similar problems to this one, but they were on a far smaller scale. The opposition was much lighter. Nevertheless, the experience gained in these operations has been invaluable in planning for this one. We don't know as yet the details of the first landing operations, but usually an invasion force strikes in three waves. First comes the assault force, which is composed mainly of infantry, supported sometimes by light tanks, and usually also including assault engineers. Its job is to strike quickly, to break up initial enemy resistance, and to secure a foothold on the shore. Before it can land, of course, it must have the support of bombing and fighting planes and of naval artillery. And you will remember that General Eisenhower's first communique emphasized the strong naval and air support which our landing was receiving. How quickly these first waves can get ashore depends on the strength of the enemy's defenses and on the effectiveness with which those defenses are reduced by bombardment.
I love the ticker, too. It's funny how that's such an artifact now. You know, 1010 Winds, the big New York news station, still has their ticker in the background. You know, there hasn't been a ticker in news in God knows how long, but, you know, nothing says news to the caveman brain like a ticker. But that's the thing, too. You know, there's so much uncertainty. We did not know what was happening. You know, even as that morning when you know, people expected an invasion, but to begin to hear that things were happening. Could you imagine covering this now? I don't think we'd have the sack collectively to do it, you know?
No, certainly not with everybody having to report what they know right away.
Right.
I mean, not just journalists, at least there's some of this audio that we went through, the reporting the day of, one of the reporters is in a plane and he says, you know, I'm not so resentful of the censorship anymore at this minute as I have been for the fat, you know, the past 2 months of them telling me I couldn't report anything. And now, you know, seeing all these men down there and being here in the plane and realizing that it was all to save lives. I just don't think it would be possible, not only out of malicious or careless things, but I mean, there was a picture the other day of former Secretary of State Clinton in the White House with somebody, and somebody just decided to take a selfie with her.
Sure.
Well, nobody had reported she was there meeting with the president, and so it became kind of, you know, not really a meaningful kerfuffle, but what if she was there for diplomacy? She was another head of state, and this was
right.
something that was delicate, you know, that people didn't know about. You wouldn't have been able to meet in private. You wouldn't have been able to be Grover Cleveland and get secret cancer surgery on your jaw.
Exactly.
You know, on a yacht, and, you know, it just wouldn't be possible today.
Yep, it's weird. So, hey, soldiers from the United Kingdom and Canada, as well as smaller nations, including Australia, Belgium, Czechoslovakia, France, Greece, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Norway, Poland, all contributed to D-Day. But because of its size and late entry into the war, America was able to provide most of the 156,000 sons of Overlord. Here's how GIs and their families heard President Roosevelt addressing the nation. Let's give a listen.
My fellow Americans, last night when I spoke with you about the fall of Rome, I knew at that moment that troops of the United States and our allies were crossing the channel in another and greater operation. It has come to pass with success thus far. And so, in this poignant hour, I ask you to join with me in prayer. Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. Lead them straight and true. Give strength to their arms, stoutness to their hearts, steadfastness in their faith. They will need thy blessings. Their road will be long and hard. For the enemy is strong. He may hurl back our forces. Success may not come with rushing speed, but we shall return again and again. And we know that by thy grace and by the righteousness of our cause, our sons will triumph. They will be sore tried by night and by day, without rest, until the victory is won. The darkness will be rent by noise and flame. Men's souls will be shaken with the violences of war. For these men are lately drawn from the ways of peace. They fight not for the lust of conquest. They fight to end conquest. They fight to liberate. They fight to let justice arise and tolerance and goodwill among all thy people. They yearn but for the end of battle, for their return to the haven of home. Some will never return. Embrace these, Father, and receive them, thy heroic servants, into thy kingdom. And for us at home, fathers, mothers, children, wives, sisters, and brothers of brave men overseas, whose thoughts and prayers are ever with them, help us, Almighty God, to rededicate ourselves in renewed faith in thee in this hour of great sacrifice. Many people have urged that I call the nation into a single day of special prayer. But because the road is long and the desire is great, I ask that our people devote themselves in a continuance of prayer. As we rise to each new day, and again when each day is spent, let words of prayer be on our lips, invoking thy help to our efforts. Give us strength, too, strengthen our daily tasks, to redouble the contributions we make in the physical and the material support of our armed forces. And let our hearts be stout, to wait out the long travel, to bear sorrows that may come, to impart our courage unto our sons, wheresoever they may be. And, O Lord, give us faith. Give us faith in thee, faith in our sons, faith in each other, faith in our united crusade. Let not the keenness of our spirit ever be dulled. Let not the impacts of temporary events, of temporal matters of but fleeting moment, let not these deter us in our unconquerable purpose. With thy blessing, we shall prevail over the unholy forces of our enemy. Help us to conquer the apostles of greed and racial arrogances. Lead us to the saving of our country, and with our sister nations into a world unity that will spell a sure peace, a peace invulnerable to the schemings of unworthy men, and a peace that will let all men live in freedom, reaping the just rewards of their honest toil. Thy will be done, Almighty God. Amen.
The apostles of greed. I love that. It's such a an amazing line. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I was going to say what we talked about there about 156,000.
Yep.
I mean, there's a lot more. Think about all the support troops you need. Think about all the men. There's a great old propaganda film from the war, and they talk about how many men it takes just to support every artillery piece. You know, it's not just one for one. I mean, this is literally millions of people that are dedicated to this undertaking, and any one of them can be that nail in the hoof of the horse that makes this not work.
Right.
So it's really a huge undertaking, and people want to do something, and they're sending them out there like FDR did. Mayor LaGuardia in New York issues a similar statement. All corners of the Allied world, people really have nothing to do but look at the sky and go to church and pray and hope, because there's nothing else that they can do, you know?
No.
And we do have audio from some of these other heads of occupied nations, by the way, because, you know, we don't want this just to be focused on the English-speaking world.
Right.
But a lot of that audio quality was really bad. We didn't want to subject you to it. And mostly they read from a familiar script. Organized resistance groups, they tell them, keep your powder dry, wait for the signal to strike. They didn't want them popping their heads up too early. They wanted to hit the Nazis when it would hurt the most, and not prematurely, when it would maybe damage the overall effort.
Right. And whether you were in an occupied nation with news really tightly controlled or watching the ticker in Times Square, the uncertainty after D-Day lingered for weeks. You had to worry not just about the outcome of the war, but whether your dad, your brother, your son would come home alive. You know, again, your main source of news would be dispatches like this one from the BBC. Give a listen.
Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France. It was announced soon after this communique that General Montgomery was in charge of the army group carrying out the assault. This army group includes British, Canadian, and United States forces. Correspondents at Supreme Headquarters say the landings were in Normandy, and they took place between 6 o'clock and 8:15. Airborne landings have also been carried out in addition to those made from the sea. Minesweepers swept away into the coast. Battleships, monitors, and cruisers carried out long-range bombardments of German coastal defense batteries, while destroyers and special coastal forces of the landing craft type bombarded the batteries and beach defenses from nearer the shore. Both the Royal Navy and United States Navy supplied the landing craft. About half the smaller types of the British landing craft were manned and commanded by men of the Royal Marines, and some of the infantry carrying ships flew the red ensign of the British Merchant Navy. Correspondents at Supreme Headquarters say the naval aspect of the operation is predominantly British. Of the normal types of warships employed, the proportion is about 3 British to 1 American. The overall proportion, including landing craft, is about 3 British ships to 2 American ships. American battleships and United States naval aircraft are taking part. Transport routes across northern France were pounded throughout the night. Dutch Mitchells and Royal Air Force, Polish and Australian Mosquitoes of the RAF 2nd Tactical Air Force concentrated their attacks on roads, railways and bridges, embankments, cuttings and junctions, and other points in the transport network over a huge area where traffic blocks would be a nuisance to the enemy. There was a large amount of cloud over France, and a number of the Mitchells came back without bombing. The Mosquitoes nearly all found their targets, and pilots reported successful attacks on a convoy, rail and road junctions, and parked vehicles. RAF Bostons were engaged in smoke-laying operations in the English Channel. Observers on the coast say that activity during the night was on an unprecedented scale, and here in London there was a constant stream of aircraft overhead. The offensive has continued since dawn, and people on the coast have seen particularly strong formations of fighters flying out towards Dieppe. Strong forces of bombers are also reported to have crossed the east coast this morning, and there was great fighter activity. The German Overseas News Agency has been issuing frequent reports about the Allied landings. These say that the combined landing operations encompass the entire coastal sector between Le Havre and Cherbourg, that reinforcements were landed at dawn, and that several battleships are shelling the shore to cover waves of landing craft. Berlin reports that the area of Caen appears to be the first focal point in the fighting, and that in this area, German troops are in fierce combat with British and American units landed from the air and the sea. Caen, capital of the department of Calvados, stands on the River Orne about 10 miles inland behind the flat coast. His Majesty the King will broadcast this evening at 19 hours Greenwich Mean Time, that is at 9 p.m. double British summer time. General de Gaulle has arrived in England. He will broadcast a message to the French people later today. That is the end of this news bulletin from the BBC, London.
Here's a unique voice from D-Day. This is King George VI of England. And as you know, if you saw the King's speech, which was great, I love that they're still making movies like this, you know, to give us something to hold on to, any sort of foothold, pardon the pun, as a reminder as to what was going on. You know what? I'm all for it. But he was never meant to wear the crown, and public speaking was a special challenge for him. You can hear him struggling to get the words out, but he truly rises to the occasion. Here is King George VI.
This is London calling in the overseas service of the BBC, calling New Zealand, Australia, the Far East, India, Persia and Iraq, East Africa, the Near East, Italy, North Africa, Malta, Gibraltar, and the whole of the Mediterranean area, Central Africa, South Africa, West Africa, Canada, the United States of America, the British West Indies, Central America, and South America. His Majesty the King.
4 years ago, our nation and empire stood alone against an overwhelming enemy with our backs to the wall, tested as never before in our history, in God's providence. We survived that test. The spirit of the people, resolute, dedicated, burnt like a bright flame, lit surely from those unseen fires which nothing can quench. once more the supreme test has to be faced. This time, the challenge is not to fight to survive, but to fight to win the final victory for the good cause. Once again, what is demanded from us all is something more than courage, more than endurance. We needed a revival of spirit, a new, unconquerable resolve. After nearly 5 years of toil and suffering, we must renew that crusading impulse on which we entered the war and met its darkest hour. We and our allies are sure that our fight is against evil and for a world in which goodness and honor may be the foundation of the life of men in every land. That we may be worthily matched with this new summons of destiny, I desire solemnly to call my people to prayer and dedication. We are not unmindful of our own shortcomings. And present. We shall ask not that God may do our will, but that we may be enabled to do the will of God. And we dare to believe that God has used our nation and empire as an instrument for fulfilling his high purpose. I hope that throughout the present crisis of the liberation of Europe, there may be offered up earnest, continuous, and widespread prayer. We who remain in this land can most effectively enter into the sufferings of subjugated Europe by prayer, whereby we can fortify the determination of our sailors, soldiers, and airmen who go forth to set the captives free. The Queen joins with me in sending you this message. She well understands the anxieties and cares of our women folk at this time. And she knows that many of them will find, as she does herself, fresh strength and comfort in such waiting upon God. He feels that many women will be glad in this way to keep vigil with their men as they man of the ships, storm of the beaches, and fill the skies. At this historic moment, surely not one of us is too busy, too young, or too old to play a part in a nationwide, a worldwide vigil of prayer as the great crusade set forth. If from every place of worship, from home and factory, from men and women of all ages, and many races and occupations, our intercessions rise, then, please God, both now and in the future, not remote, the predictions of an ancient psalm may be fulfilled. The Lord will give strength unto his people. The Lord will give his people the blessing of peace.
Now, from a guy who had a hard time with public speaking to a man who was born to it, here is news legend Edward R. Murrow painting a picture of the landings for anxious listeners back home.
All day, Allied heavy bombers have been operating in support of the ground troops. They have encountered no fighter opposition. The action so far seems to have been almost too easy. But the reputation of the German armies is still considerable, and there is no disposition to discount their power to hit back. There is no official admission that our bridgehead is free from concentrated artillery fire. But the general impression is that we are now in a position to start pouring the material ashore, the tanks and the self-propelled artillery. Eyewitness accounts indicate that all movement has ceased in the area of the attack. The roads and rails carry no traffic. That means that the bombers can now start working further inland. Here is a report from Charles Collingwood, Columbia's correspondent with the Navy, who was with a tank landing craft. He says the first craft onto the beaches were the little LCVPs. They came in doggedly, looking very small and gallant with their heads up. Offshore, several miles, loomed the silhouettes of the big ships. Between them and the beaches milled an assemblage of landing craft of all kinds, forming up, waiting to go in. A few thousand yards offshore, two patrol boats stood, a mile or so apart. They marked the starting line. They were just out of range of effective machine gun fire. On those boats, each wave of landing craft dressed like a unit of foot soldiers and were then dispatched to the beach. More and more men reached the beach. At one end of the beachhead, a little knot of German prisoners began to form. Back among the big ships, the admiral decided he could now send in his bigger landing vessels, send them into the shore. The LCIs and the LSDs sidled to the starting line and then headed for the beach. An LCI is 155 feet long and carries more than 200 soldiers. When she hits the shore, a ramp is let down from each side and the soldiers pour out onto the beach. An LST is bigger still. She's a great floating garage. When she reaches shore, her mouth opens and trucks and vehicles of every description roll out of her and are lifted by davits from her hold. When these ships go in, the landing is well underway, and their cargo is quickly built up, the power of the assault.
Hearing him is amazing. You know, we didn't have the footage, the visuals that are now for us the most familiar thing, and thank goodness we didn't. I mean, you know, imagine how horrible the landing is to witness. Imagine getting that footage home now, early. We just thought about what we were talking about a second ago, about, you know, would we have the sack to continue? Thank goodness we weren't able to see that footage now. We weren't able to see the horror that was unfolding on the beach. But we needed men like Murrow and guys like, you know, Ernie Pyle, who would lose his life 12 months after this when he went over to the Pacific Theater. We'd be lost without them, you know. And talk about this notion of one thing that I think is severely lacking with a lot of journalists today, or at least, you know, radio and TV guys, is this notion of trust factor. And man, oh man, I could trust Murrow with just about anything. It was a comforting voice in a really uncomfortable time.
Yeah, and they did keep some of those pictures. Obviously, they were not rolling everything. We're going to talk about some of these famous faces from Hollywood that we know that went there. John Ford was filming, but he's on D-Day, but he's not going to send that raw right back. And it wasn't even really possible to. So, you know, there was sort of that, I don't know, percolation period, for lack of a better word. It's what pops out of my head. You know, slowly kind of wait for it to heat up. It's not people just shooting it with their phones. Because, and today you look at what happens in a war, people take fake movies and fake pictures. And I mean, if it went around the world, you know, before the truth got its pants off in World War II, I mean, imagine how fast it is now. I mean, forget it.
Oh,
before the pants are even made.
Exactly.
Put on. The lie is all the way around.
Exactly. Oh, it's awful. Well, again, like we said, we're recording this on June 14th. That would have been D-Day plus 8. in 1944, and we try to stress that this was not, you know, this wasn't a one-day thing. Nothing so decisive as a single battle. The gains had to be expanded and held after those first landings, or the Allies would just would have been pushed back into the ocean.
One interesting thing about D-Day plus 8 was that was the day General Charles de Gaulle at last arrived back home on Normandy Beach. Journalist Alden Hatch, speaking of these journalists that painted pictures for us, this is a great one. He described the scene as de Gaulle's landing craft arrived. He said, quote, "General de Gaulle clambered out and stood on the wet sand of France. A drifting scent of apple blossoms was almost too sweet to be borne. It was 4 years almost to the day since he had flown into exile," unquote.
It's an amazing quote. And of course, as Woody Allen would tell us later in Sleepers, he was a French chef. He had a cooking show.
He showed you how to make soufflés and omelets and everything.
He was an interesting guy. Men waited to pour into France as the salient expanded. In his book, Diaries of a British Tank Commander, Sergeant Trevor Greenwood wrote on D-Day plus 8, quote, "Amazed that I don't feel terrified about impending events, but I'm not looking forward to action," end quote. That's because you're human, buddy.
It is very human, because the guys who died on D-Day plus one or plus eight, or any of the ones in between until the war end, or even in the occupation after, their lives are every bit as real. This was not a one-day event.
And, no.
You know, when we say that, we're not being condescending to the people listening, but just
not
something we like to remind ourselves of.
Right.
A lot of these guys, you know, they weren't committed Nazis that were on the German side. You talk about the Wehrmacht, and, you know, you talk about, I mean, Rommel ends up getting executed by Hitler.
Exactly.
You know, and then he was actually a much more anti-Nazi figures than we know all about the Valkyrie, played by Tom Cruise.
Yep.
Those guys weren't really.
They
just kind of wanted to win, and they kind of believed in it more. And I guess that's why Rommel gets a little bit of a softening from history. But
sure.
It's good that they try to bring everybody together. The Russians always feel a little awkward at D-Day things.
Yeah,
but, they certainly took a huge pounding. So this probably looks a little odd to them, maybe.
Yep.
But anyway, back in the era we're supposed to be in, the Allies received a mix of good and bad reports as they expanded into France. The Soviets are our allies at this point. And perhaps the best bit of good news that first day came, not for the Soviets, but for the Allies, and it came from a surprising source. Here's CBS newsman Bob Trout again. He's been going all night long at this point, carrying all the coverage. He just started this off with a tour of the newsroom, really kind of vamping for time, and then this, you know, biggest news story in history hits, and you can hear the strain in his voice.
Columbia's news headquarters in New York once again. We've been hearing from Columbia's correspondents in Washington, Bill Henry and Bill McCaffrey. We've been broadcasting here all night as the invasion of northern France finally got underway. I beg your pardon. That's the result of broadcasting most of the night. That was the first time we switched to Washington to get the reaction from our own capital city. And now back here in Columbia's news headquarters, let us hear some military news and a military analysis from Major George Fielding Elliott. And here's Major Elliott.
I would like, first of all, to call your attention to the Reuters dispatch, which you heard read by Mr. Trout a little earlier this morning, to the effect that Adolf Hitler is taking personal command of all German anti-invasion operations, surrounded by a large and presumably gilded staff. I would like to remind you that the last time that Adolf Hitler took personal command of the German military operations was on the occasion when Marshal von Bock advised the Führer that he should not proceed with the German drive on Stalingrad until he had secured the crossings of the Middle Don in the area of Voronezh. And Adolf Hitler didn't like this delay. He overruled Marshal von Bock. He took personal command himself, and we all know what happened at Stalingrad. So this is really a very hopeful sign.
Really a hopeful sign. Yes, it really is a hopeful sign.
And I love that it wasn't even today. We might have something in the press where we mocked somebody. But they really meant it. It was really true. They knew, as I said, a guy like Rommel, these trained generals, they knew the mistakes that Hitler was making. And so when they looked at it, and I've heard the rumors, and as loath as we are to pass on rumors, this one seems like somebody must have thought it. If they had a chance to kill Hitler, the war would have lasted much longer.
Right.
Because, yeah, at least later in the war, and we're not talking early in the war or when he was still a painter or anything like that, but, you know, later in the war, he was making so many crazy decisions, you know, or just tactically unsound decisions, you know. And so he really was a help.
Yeah, it was.
Keep listening to the mustache, man.
Exactly. I mean, Battle of Bulge was one thing, you know, that would be, I guess, 6 months later almost. But yeah, you're right. It's an interesting point to think of. Gosh, if he had been taken out earlier, things could have been a lot worse.
Yeah, I guess it's one of those things. Take him out at a key moment or leave the person in there. Or, I mean, you know, you could say that, I guess, about our revolution. I mean, if King George hadn't been going mad, if he'd been replaced at a key point, then maybe things would have turned out different.
Yep.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its 5-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
You had a great idea about placing familiar faces on those beaches, Owen, from TV shows, movies that we grew up watching and we still see today. Let's start with everyone's favorite Scotsman.
Ah, yes, James Doohan. And this, again, this is not to make light of any of this. For me, in fact, it served the purpose of doing quite the opposite. You know how much we love Star Trek and how we sort of use that as a lens to look at other things. And it's like, as a kid, knowing that there he is, there's Scotty, there's our Scotty, and also knowing that on D-Day, he got shot 6 times. He was there to save the world, and he did his part. And years later, you know, you'd watch all these guys who would come through, and so many of these people fought in the Second World War. But to me, it's like I look at him, and I'm reminded of D-Day. I'm reminded of what he did during the war. And that, to me, it's called another gift of Star Trek, or call it what you want. But anything that helps attach some sort of enduring memory to it, for me, is wonderful. It's like one of the things I try to do with my boy, you know? It's like he's getting his proper Star Trek, and then eventually, you know, he'll come to understand that, you know, James Doohan was more than just Scotty. And I think this is hugely important, especially the further away we go. But Lieutenant James Doohan, 13th Field Artillery Regiment of the 3rd Canadian Infantry Division. He landed on Juno, the Canadian beach, caught several rounds, lost a finger. A couple episodes of Trek where you can see it. He does a great job of covering it up. You know, it's funny, you know, he had the loss of his fingers. Gary Berghoff had a physical deformity, and you'd see him on MASH. Occasionally, he'd be able to do that. Just one of those things we think of, you know. But he had caught a bullet in the chest also doing, but in the great tradition of TR, instead of an eyeglass case that stopped the bullet, it was doing a cigarette case. He was known as, quote, the craziest pilot in the Royal Canadian Air Force.
You were supposed to prevent trouble, Mr. Scott.
Aye, Captain.
Go ahead and take another one, Dean.
Charles Durning,
who
passed away just recently, U.S. Army, among the first wave to land at Omaha Beach. You know him from a million things. Just a fabulous character actor. Probably the most recent thing was he played the priest in Everybody Loves Raymond.
Yep.
He was in Tootsie, just a fantastic old character actor. And this is his tragic story, the only member of his unit to survive a machine gun ambush.
We could do an episode on Durning or any of these people. Go read Durning's obit, folks. You can easily find it. Go read that man's obituary. Sit and ask yourself how your day's going.
Yeah, we'll link to that at angryhistory.com for sure. It's a good idea, yeah.
Another one, David Niven. Niven landed after D-Day as part of the Phantom Signals Unit. Even now, he said, 4 decades later, of the concentration camps he helped liberate, quote, I sometimes fancy that I can catch a hint of the stench in my nostrils and my stomach heaves. I feel like it will never leave me, end quote. Yeah, smell is probably the biggest memory trigger, isn't it?
Yeah, huge memory. And he had a tough life, too.
Oh,
that's
gosh.
Another thing that we'll link to.
Oh, my gosh. What the thing about his wife that you sent me this morning? That was horrible.
Yeah.
No.
terrible, yeah. Tyrone Power's house, hide and seek, and the poor lady decided to step into what she thought was a good hiding spot, and it was a 20-foot drop, hit her head, and this is 1946, and died.
Awful.
Terrible. These people definitely lived real lives, and obviously he felt it was his purpose, obviously because he said it, to make people laugh, make people have a better life.
Why don't you take this next one, because I'm not a Yankee fan.
Seaman Second Class Lawrence Peter Yogi Berra, U.S. Navy. Now, anybody who is even on Earth, I think, knows of Yogi Berra, even if they're not,
Absolutely.
Even if they've never heard of baseball in America, even if they've never gone to a game. Everybody knows his yogiisms. He is still with us. Unfortunately, he was not able to make it over there for the 70th events, but he's a legendary Yankee. He won 10 World Series titles.
Mm-hmm.
He manned an LCSS boat, and he joked the letters stood for Landing Craft Suicide Squad. But they had the duty to hang back and provide cover fire for the men on the beach. And there's a great part of his story. He's only 19, this kid from St. Louis, and he talks about he has that kind of childlike way about him. And he said, I was standing up in the boat and looking at the rockets that the Germans were firing and that we were firing. And I was saying, oh, it looks like fireworks. Oh, and he was enjoying it. And then I think the captain of the boat comes and tells him, stick your head down before you get shot off. He's like, Yogi said, quote, I didn't do anything special. We all germed up back then. We loved America and had to beat those Nazis. I went in with everyone else. Some never came back. I was lucky, unquote.
J.D. Salinger, Staff Sergeant, U.S. Army, Catcher in the Rye. When he landed on Utah Beach, Salinger was carrying the first six chapters of Catcher in the Rye, amazingly. Reminds me of how Tolkien wrote The Hobbit in a foxhole. Not quite, but he was during wartime. I mean, it's very similar. He served in the Signal Corps in counterintelligence, interrogated Nazis, fought in the Battle of the Bulge, and was one of the first to reach Dachau.
John Ford, we mentioned earlier, commander in the U.S. Navy aboard the USS Plunkett, stationed off Omaha Beach. He went ashore that first day, was filming the battle. He was later promoted to Rear Admiral in the Navy Reserve, which is amazing when you consider the films that he made.
Yep, absolutely.
You can't win, Darth. If you strike me down, I shall become more powerful than you can possibly imagine.
And then Alec Guinness, you know, you talk about someone else from our sci-fi past. Us guys were coming up in the 70s. But Alec Guinness, Obi-Wan, he ferried British troops aboard landing craft onto Normandy beaches. Obviously, these are just a handful of the well-knowns. And as much as they put me in a mind to remember, it opens up and it begins to attach stories and faces to all the men that took those beaches. I have a hard time now, the older I get, watching that footage. You know, there was something about it when I was a kid where there was some visceral excitement to seeing these guys come ashore. And then you realize, watching them die and watching them drop, those are real lives. And those are plans that will never be made. Those were marriages that will never happen. Those are children that will never be born. And it's real. And we did it for all the right reasons.
And this is a good kind of cross-section of America, of Britain. And you think of all the people that were lost there that would have made great contributions like this, you know, not just in acting or in sci-fi, but these people contributed all of them in other ways too, not just entertainment.
Absolutely.
There's plenty of people there, but these are familiar faces. And if that's what it takes for us to kind of have a gut check and put a face to the name, then I'm all for it.
Absolutely.
We also have to mention Theodore Roosevelt Jr. At 56, he was the oldest man and highest ranking soldier to go ashore on D-Day. He was a general. Mm-hmm. He'd pleaded for months to lead the attack on Utah Beach. He'd even sworn his own son to secrecy when he'd had a heart attack prior to the battle because he wanted to make absolutely sure that he wasn't left at home.
Man, he's his father's son, huh?
Yeah.
Ultimately, with a cane and no helmet, Ted waded ashore, but something was wrong. The landing craft had drifted and hit the wrong beach. The soldiers looked to the son of the Rough Rider, that was painted on his Jeep, by the way, for what to do next. Here's that historic moment recreated in the movie and the brunch, The Longest Day, with Henry Fonda as Ted. Give a listen.
Beach. The land is about a mile and a quarter south of where we were supposed to land. We should be up there. The control boat must have been confused by the smoke from the naval bombardment.
I agree with you, Ted, but what are we going to do now? Our reinforcements and heavy equipment will be approaching in a very few minutes.
I know.
Well, what if they land at the right beach?
The reinforcements will have to follow us wherever we are. We're starting the war from right here.
As incredible as that sounds, and they did try to kind of debunk that after and say, well, come on, who talks that way? Well, Roosevelt, I guess, is the answer. And they said somebody would have had to have said it even if he didn't. And he was just the one walking around there, you know, urging on these young kids. I mean, you had to be terrified. But think of Yogi Berra, 19 years old,
right.
You know. You're somebody that age and you're on the beach. And then you see this old man hobbling along with a cane and not wearing a helmet because he doesn't like how it feels on his head.
Right.
I mean, I don't know. I get a bullet through the head seems like it would feel bad to me too. But okay.
It'd feel a lot worse, although you probably wouldn't know, right? My goodness.
You didn't want to get hat head.
Yeah, right.
And,
Come on, Ted.
it really did inspire them, and he was just an incredible soldier. He did run for governor of New York, of course, but I think they say he was sort of a casual politician rather, and a career soldier. And his father was kind of the opposite. He went to San Juan. Not that that wasn't a real war. Not that people didn't die and it wasn't bravery. But Ted, completely wounded, you know, really wounded heavily, and all TR's sons went to fight.
That's right.
And this really turned the tide. Unfortunately, his heart gave out 5 weeks later after D-Day. General George S. Patton, who served as one of Ted's pallbearers, said Ted was the bravest man he ever knew. And when asked to name the most heroic act he witnessed, General Omar Bradley said Theodore Roosevelt at Utah Beach. Ted was awarded almost every military decoration America has, and the French Croix de Guerre twice. Not once, but twice. Wow. World War One, he'd served and went and gave, and that's how he ended up with that cane.
Yep.
And he just was a real amazing figure in his own right, and it's tough that he carried the name of a giant. And it's not always easy to do. Alice once said that poor Ted, if he walks across the street, there's 100 people that'll say TR would have done it better. And if he walks across the street the right way, they say, oh, he did it just like TR would have done. For me, when I think of Ted, that's always something that's really connected to him.
That's pretty awesome. All right, so those are a few voices of D-Day as you've heard them that day in 1944, 70 years ago. It sets us up nicely for a report on what the beaches are like today. We've already heard some really interesting stuff, pretty emotional stuff too, from our man in Normandy, Mojo, and we look forward to sharing those stories with you.
We'll leave you now with another piece of Little Played audio. It's that clip of General Eisenhower on the 2-year anniversary of the D-Day landings. It's worth noting that as president on the 10th anniversary, Ike avoided any of the big commemorations of the sort mm-hmm. we're familiar with in recent decades. Not that we don't need to do that now, but at the time it was still so fresh, the death and the destruction, the sacrifice on those beaches, men like Robert Dole and mm-hmm. Daniel Inouye, we've talked about, who were later senators, you know, they're still struggling to overcome their injuries by this point. And so it was still a little too raw for the man who gave the order to say, go.
And this is another reminder to ourselves about romanticizing this war and war in general. You know, we're still fighting now, and it seems like so many people just can't even compute, you know. We can't ever forget our veterans. I don't want to go off on that tangent, but you know, romanticizing war and the carnage that went with it. Over 425,000 Allied and German troops were killed, wounded, or went missing during the Battle of Normandy, and as many as 20,000 French civilians were killed. 27 cemeteries hold the 110,000 dead from both sides. We'll bring you a report from there as soon as we can.
That's it for our Voices of D-Day show, setting up our later show where we're going to really grill Mojo on exactly what it's like to walk there today. And he's a guy very much, I think, a kindred spirit of Owen and I.
Oh,
and
certainly.
He would get angry if he saw bad stuff there, and it seems like he was really inspired by this trip to Normandy, which is exactly what you want to hear. People clearing a path for veterans in wheelchairs and this kind of thing. So we're really looking forward to bringing that to you.
Absolutely. Listen, I'm Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Karyanis.
Thank you so much, as always, for being with us, and we will see you guys very, very soon. Bye-bye.
2 years ago, on D-Day, the American soldier again proved his outstanding worthiness as a fighting man. No obstacle could stop him. No enemy could withstand his outstanding courage, a determination, and will to win. We have yet to complete the job he so well advanced at such great cost. For victory in war is barren until a secure peace has been established. Young men who have not yet done their share must now come forward to help bear the burden. May the memory of what the American fighting man accomplished renew in us a firm resolve to see the job through. We, whose strength did so much to win the shooting war, cannot afford to grow laggard now. That we owe to every man who fell on D-Day and on so many other fields throughout the war.
June 6, 1944, and the greatest armada in military history is assembled in England for an assault on Hitler's fortress Europe. For this long-awaited D-Day, the Allies have assembled 12,000 planes to protect a surface force of 4,000 ships, all under the supreme command of General Dwight D. Eisenhower, who has British General Montgomery at his side. The Allied forces have nearly 3 million troops trained for the assault, and British and U.S. planes bomb the French coast around the clock, dropping 9,000 tons of explosives during a few hours before the landing. Awesome force of 1,000 planes and gliders thrusts deep into France to drop men of the U.S. 101st and 82nd Airborne and the British 6th. Their might darkens the skies over Normandy. The Allies have complete control of the air and cover the surface forces as Allied troops pile into landing craft to hit the coast from Cherbourg to Le Havre. As they prepare to move in, 500 warships lay down a withering barrage. Troops move in aboard LCTs and LSTs, and it's the beginning of the end for Hitler's dreams of world conquest. German resistance proves less than was feared, and wave after wave hits the beach. Casualties were heavy in those early hours, but the Allies were on their way to Berlin.
Visit angryhistory.com to learn more about the topics discussed on today's episode. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You can also like us on Facebook, tweet us at Angry History, or send us an email to angry@angryhistory.com.
A stupendous attack on the fortified coast split the German high command. General Rommel wanted to move his forces to the beaches. Von Rundstedt wanted to wait until the Allies moved inland. When they finally decided on action, it was too late. The beachhead had been firmly established. Less than a year later, General Eisenhower had Germany's unconditional surrender. D-Day will stand in history as one of the greatest military feats of all time. The determination of free men to triumph over tyranny rose to new heights on the beaches of Normandy.